You know, some of you know I was
had a chance last week. We flew back to see Tommy and Jamie and the girls in Texas. And that was kind of on the edge because I had jury duty the week before. Right? And so I wasn't really worried because it was like, okay, I got jury duty this week. And then the next week we're flying back, so it's all good. Well, you know how that works. You call up, you know, Sunday night, no, you have to come in. Sweet. Monday night, no, you have to come in. Sweet. Tuesday night, no. Wednesday night, yeah, you got to be here. So I'm thinking Thursday. I've never actually been on a jury. I've never actually done anything more than kind of go down to the courthouse and have them say go home. Right? So I'm thinking, it's all good, it's all good. Sure enough, Thursday, I'm sitting there, you know how it is. You wait a couple hours, and now it's time, about noon, and you go to lunch, and you still haven't done anything, right? And then you come back, and sure enough, they say, oh, yeah, you're in this panel.
So, okay, I'm kind of excited because it's like, I've never done this. This will be fun, you know. And so I go into the room and kind of sit there and spend sort of the rest of the afternoon listening to people talk and things like that. And come back on Friday, and the judge is explaining, yeah, this will be like a five-day trial starting on Monday. And I'm just like, oh, my word. And so I'm thinking, okay, no problem. You know, believe it or not, we had purchased the plane tickets with a credit card that actually allowed you to cancel because of jury duty and get your money back. So I'm thinking, okay, at least I'm not out money. I'm thinking, okay, Elizabeth can fly ahead and maybe I'll get there or whatever. And so I'm sitting there Friday and you go through everything and I'm in the jury box, and at like 3:45, they dismissed me. They didn't want me. And so it's like, whew, that is so good. So that was great. Not that I wouldn't mind being on a jury. It actually is kind of interesting to me, having just been on that side of the process. But, you know, the jury trial is sort of something we enjoy. We benefit from. It's not always been that way. Right? If you go back in time, throughout most of human history, there were two ways. The basic way was just sort of the king or the local noble just kind of heard what was going on and decided. For a lot of history, especially during the medieval period, they did what they called a trial by ordeal, which was really, it sounds kind of peculiar, but it really was a way of trying to, if you really couldn't decide and you really wanted to make the right decision, well, God knows, right? So if somebody's accused of a crime and he says he didn't do it, but other people are pretty sure he did, and you're just, I don't know, and I want to make the right decision, we know God knows the truth. So a trial by ordeal, there were kind of three ways. One way is you would have like a pot of boiling water with a rock at the bottom. And you'd put your hand in and pull out the rock. And obviously you'd burn your hand, right? And so it would be wrapped and treated. And then after a period of like 3 or 4 days, they would unwrap the bandage. And if your hand was healing, that was a sign that God had protected you and you were innocent. If your hand was all like pussy and infected, well, you must have been guilty. They do the same thing by having you carry a piece of hot iron, like heat up a piece of iron and say, hand it to you, and you had to like walk a certain distance and the same thing. For women, they did this thing where they would kind of bind them up, like wrap up their hands and feet, and throw them into a body of water like a lake that had been blessed by a priest. And the thinking was that since they bless the lake, it's holy, and if the person is innocent, the lake will receive that person. But if she's guilty, the lake won't receive her and she'll float. So if you floated, you were considered innocent, and they would fish you out and untie you and let you go. If you were guilty, you know, you would float, and then they would execute you. If you were innocent, you sank. And hopefully they got you out before you drowned, because this is kind of a lose-lose situation, right? Either I drown or I drown. Just weird ways of doing justice. At the time of Jesus, we obviously are in a time before the trial by ordeal, when it's just people like Herod and Pilate that are going to decide. And so that's where we are in Luke's gospel. We're in chapter 23, and what we have is this time when Jesus is going to be brought before Pilate, brought before Herod, and they are going to decide his fate. Now, before we get into the story, we need to sort of step up and remember what we know to be true, which is that even though Pilate and Herod think they have authority in this matter, they think they're deciding this, they have no more authority than what God allows them, right? This from the human sort of view of the events, Pilate and Herod are deciding the fate, right? From the eternal view, this is God's plan, right? And in John's gospel, there's a conversation the conversation between Pilate and Jesus recorded in John's gospel has this. Pilate says to Jesus, "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" He's asking questions and not getting an answer, and he's trying to help Jesus understand, hey, man, this is down to me. I mean, if I want you crucified, I just say the word and that's it. You better think about representing yourself well and trying to talk your way out of this, because all these guys are saying crucify you and you're not saying anything in your defense. And Jesus kind of looks at him and says, you have no authority over me unless it's given to you from above. You don't have authority over me. You only have the authority that God, my Father, gives you. That's all. So we need to remember that. We remember that all that's happened that we've been studying over the last month or so, the events of the night before, the events today that we're going to be looking at in the days ahead, all of this is a plan ordained by God. And you even need to see that the reason that's important is because we need to recognize that even things that work out the way the people involved want it to work out, it's not because they want it to work out that way. That, too, is God's plan, right? For example, I'm just going to give you one, but the Sanhedrin, the Jewish rulers that are pushing to have Christ crucified, they want Jesus crucified by Rome because that way it will represent sort of the confirmation of their position in the community. And it won't be sort of a mass sort of mob thing like they're going to do with Stephen later. If you know Acts, well, they just kind of, the mob just kind of starts stoning Stephen. They want this sort of publicly done as a public demonstration of their authority in this matter. And that's exactly what they get. But they don't get it because they want it. They get it because the Bible prophesied Jesus had to be crucified. Right? That's why this comes down. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They have pierced my hands and feet. That's a description of crucifixion way back in the Psalms. That's why Jesus was crucified. Right? Not because the Sanhedrin wanted it. Not because the Romans did it that way. It's because that's the way God had ordained it. Jesus himself had said this, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes. They will condemn him to death. He will be handed over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him, and on the third day he will be raised up." We're going into Jerusalem, guys, and here's what's going to happen. Not because they want it so, but because God wants it so. This is a sovereign plan. This is a sovereign plan. So we're in Luke chapter 23, and we're going to look at the first 12 verses. And here's how it reads. "Then the whole body of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.' And Pilate asked him, saying, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And he answered him and said, 'It is as you say.' And Pilate said to the chief priests and the multitudes, 'I find no guilt in this man.' But they kept on insisting, saying, 'He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place.' Now when Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was himself also in Jerusalem at that time. Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at length, but he answered nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod, with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before that they had been at enmity with each other." Interesting reconciliation, sort of a footnote at the end that we'll get into in a little while. So it begins, the Sanhedrin, again, in our narrative, where are we? We've been in the garden, right? Jesus has been arrested. He's been sort of grilled by Caiaphas, grilled by the rest of the Sanhedrin. At that time, Peter is in the courtyard denying him, right? Then, because they have to meet during the daytime, the Sanhedrin, for this to be a valid trial, they kind of lock Jesus up for the rest of the night, although who knows if that's just a couple of hours, right? Because these other events kind of took place from sort of 11 midnight on to 2, 3, 4 in the morning. So we've kind of, now we've kind of taken about a 3 or 4 hour break. It's sunrise now. It's daylight. So now the Sanhedrin can act officially. And so they do that. They have one last meeting. They find Jesus guilty and they haul him off before Pilate. And so they want to act in unanimity. So they all go together, right? The whole body of them got up and brought him before Jesus. Is that all 70 of them? I don't know. But clearly the point would be that this is not just one or two guys, right? The Sanhedrin wants to make the point to Pilate that this is something we all agree with. We all agree with. So they all go. And they want Pilate to simply sort of summarily execute Jesus, right? They're trying to kind of speed up the process. They want Jesus dead. If we all go there, we're hoping Pilate's going to say, well, really, all of you agree? Well, okay, there must not be much for me to do. We'll take care of it. That's what they're going for here. That's what they're going for. Pilate is the Roman procurator, right? He's the Roman ruler in this area, and he's in Jerusalem. Normally he wouldn't be, but he is now because it's Passover. Right? Passover, we've been talking about. This is the celebration in Jerusalem. There are tens, perhaps 100,000 Jews there. It's a time where tensions are raised. Anytime you put that many people into a crowded city, it's a time when talk always seems to bubble up about revolt against Rome. So it's a good place if you're the local leader to be. You want to be on the scene, right? You don't want to hear about this from 50 or 100 miles away. You want to be in Jerusalem during Passover. And in fact, Herod is in Jerusalem during Passover, right? Everybody's going to be there. We need to be on the spot. The Sanhedrin goes to Pilate's headquarters. He's probably at Herod's palace, right? He's probably at Herod's palace. And they don't go inside because that would be something that would then keep them from eating Passover. Remember, they haven't even eaten Passover yet. One of the ironies in this is that these people who are supposed to be enforcing the Jewish law have actually postponed their own celebration of that law so that they can crucify Jesus. Because, they're going to get defiled, so they have to kind of like not eat Passover yet until we deal with this Jesus guy. Then we can. So they're waiting outside. And John's gospel gives us that detail. So who's this Pilate? He is the fifth one to be procurator of Judea and Samaria. And there's really not a lot about him in sort of the historical record. Right? If you kind of step outside of the Bible and you say, okay, well, give me sort of some information on this Pilate. Who is he? We don't have a lot. We do have one particular source that's pretty helpful. A guy named Philo of Alexandria. He's a Jewish philosopher. Alexandria is in Egypt, if you're not familiar with that. So that's where he's based. And Alexandria in the ancient world was a center of learning. So he's kind of the center of intellectual development. And he was familiar. He traveled a lot. He was sort of an ambassador for the Jewish people. And he quotes a letter from King Herod Agrippa to Caligula, the emperor, describing Pilate in this way: inflexible, merciless, and obstinate. So, stepping back, you're going to be brought before a judge. Those are probably not the words you're looking for in a judge, right? You probably don't want your judge to be inflexible, merciless, and obstinate. But that's who Jesus' judge is going to be. Pilate did not like the Jews. He did not choose this position. He's trying to work his way up the Roman hierarchy, and he's sort of assigned to this place. He didn't like the Jews. He had done a couple of things particularly that were offensive. One of the things he did was he actually used the temple treasury to pay for enlarging the aqueducts in the area. He thought, well, mostly it's Jews here in Jerusalem, so we'll just use their money to sort of increase the water supply. Another thing he did when he had actually taken over, when he had been given the position, as often happens, you make sort of your inaugural parade or your sort of great entrance into the city. He kind of came in with banners of the pagan gods that Rome worshipped and kind of paraded through Jerusalem with this and then installed those very banners in the temple. Kind of an in-your-face, yeah, I know this is your sacred holy place, but you know what? No, Jupiter reigns here.
right?
And so he took a very contentious, very confrontational attitude towards the Jews. He was going to assert that he is in charge. Okay? There was such a revolt over that that there was riots in the street, and eventually he backed down. He was actually going to sort of persecute everybody at first and protest against this, but he remembered that he has one job. Well, two really. One job is to keep the tax money coming in, and the second is to make sure things are quiet. Right? It's just really what you want, the Romans wanted from their local rulers, is keep the tax money coming in and don't cause a lot of problems. Because if you cause a lot of problems and we have to send an army there, that's going to cost us money, right? So we're in this for business reasons. And if a riot breaks out, Rome's going to hear about it. They'll have to send a legion of troops. That's going to be expensive. He's going to get in trouble for not keeping the peace. So as much as he wanted to sort of wipe everybody out, he couldn't do that. Scripture has Pilate mentioned in a couple places. We talked about this probably a year and a half ago. Luke wrote in verse 1 of chapter 13 that Jesus was told about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Right? So what was that about? Well, what we think about is that probably some people from Galilee had gone to make sacrifices, and Pilate, for whatever reason, had simply had them killed. We don't know much more about it than that. We don't know if it was at a particular feast, like Passover, or if it was at the Feast of Dedication. We don't know why he had them killed. Trying to sort of view this historically, it may have been because Galilee, as we'll see, was sort of a hotbed of what were called the Zealots, right? You know, one of the disciples was Simon the Zealot. These were sort of the radical element that wanted to overthrow Rome by force, the Roman presence by force. And Galilee was sort of a hotbed of that. It was sort of a center of that. So it may have been a bunch of those guys down there, and they were doing whatever they were doing, and Pilate wanted to take them out. We don't know. What we do know is that this was done in the temple. These people were just cut down while making their sacrifices in the temple. And this attitude of Pilate's was eventually going to get him to lose his place. Later on, he will come against some Samaritans who are trying to sort of take over Mount Gerizim because they believe that Moses left some sacred relics there, and that he's going to try to stop them, and there's going to be a revolt. And eventually this will make its way back to Rome, and Rome will say, you know, enough of you. Okay? But this is the guy. This is the guy before whom Jesus is brought by the Sanhedrin. Okay? We can't think of anything like a fair trial. You know, a lot of times, and you know, we can think of, well, the trial against Jesus wasn't fair. And we talked two weeks ago when I was here about that it wasn't fair, not only according to our standards, because that wouldn't make sense, right? We can't expect this to be a fair trial by our standards. But it wasn't even a fair trial by their standards, right? They didn't even follow their own rules. So we get this brief encounter, or this brief synopsis of the encounter in Luke's gospel, right? And it's so brief that I want to look at John's gospel too, because I want to kind of flesh out the conversation. So back in John's gospel, and I've got this in your notes for you, Pilate starts by asking his visitors the question, what accusation do you bring, right? Why are you all here? This is the morning, okay? There is no reason to think they had allowed Pilate to sleep in, right? He has probably been roused from his bed, told by his servant, said, you know, there's about 100 Jews outside. They got this guy. They're banging on the gates. They want him crucified. You better go deal with this. And so he's not had his first cup of coffee. He is probably not in the best humor anyway. And he gets out there, and his first question is, what accusation do you bring? What's going on? What's the problem? And they respond with a certain arrogance, right? They basically respond, hey, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. Right? Like, you don't need to know that. We've decided he's guilty. Just execute the judgment. Okay, that's basically all they want. They don't want anything more than that. And they don't even want to take the time to explain to Pilate why he ought to execute the judgment. Right? The simple fact is, you know, we've decided he's guilty. You need to take care of this. Pilate has no humor with this, right? Pilate just looks at them and says, take him yourselves, judge him according to your law. In other words, if this is how our conversation is going to happen, I'm out. right? What accusation do you bring? You don't need to know that, just execute. Okay, have a good day. Right, that's sort of a summary of what happens in that few minutes. Now, Pilate had to know who Jesus was. Right? Again, he's the local Roman ruler. He's in Passover because he knows Passover is a time where riots and trouble against Rome occur. He knows it's a time when there's a great sort of movement from year to year, you know, different prophets or whatever you have will rise up saying, this is the time to overthrow Rome. You know, and he's there because he knows that happens. He had to have known about Jesus because of the triumphal entry, right? Who would have missed that, right? When Jesus entered Jerusalem, all the people are out there, and what are they all saying? Hail the King of the Jews. Word of that had to make it to Pilate. He had to be aware of who Jesus was. I'm imagining, and this is just my own speculation, but thinking as Pilate ought to think, he probably did some research. Who is this guy? Is he a real threat? What do we know about this Jesus of Nazareth? Right? Give me some info on him. I want some intel on this. He had to have heard about the cleansing of the temple. No doubt he's heard about what Jesus teaches. But here's the benefit from Pilate's point of view. All of those are Jewish problems. Right? All of those are Jewish problems. Pilate is only concerned about Rome and Roman authority. He could care less who the king of the Jews is. That does not touch him at all. He cares who's in charge in Jerusalem. Right? And if Herod is the king of the Jews, whatever. If Jesus is the king of the Jews, whatever. As long as whoever is the king of the Jews is following Roman law, that's a Jewish problem. Right? So that's what Pilate is concerned about. That's what he's probably been working on trying to figure out about Jesus. Now the Sanhedrin, they can't put anybody to death and they want Jesus killed. So they have got to come up with a way to get Pilate to get Jesus executed. So naturally, they need to make Jesus look like a threat to Rome. Right? If all they do is make Jesus look like a threat to their own establishment, Pilate couldn't be bothered, because that doesn't touch him. They need to make Jesus look like a threat to Rome, and that's why they come up with the accusations that they do. Right? When you read those, didn't it surprise you? It should have, because what accusations do they bring? They claim he has been misleading our nation and forbidding paying taxes to Caesar and saying that he is Christ the King. The reason that ought to have confused you is what charge did they convict Jesus on? Blasphemy. Right? They convicted him of blasphemy. They don't bring that charge before Pilate. Why not? Because Pilate could care less. If some Jew wants to blaspheme his God, that doesn't touch me. So even though that was the one that they were most concerned about, they know as a Roman procurator, Pilate is not going to be bothered with that. They need to bring charges that Pilate will be bothered by. And you know what? Not paying taxes is a good one. Let's get him on that. The Romans love their tax money. Let's jump on the tax money. Let's jump on the fact that he's claiming to be the rightful king. Now, why might that be a problem if Pilate doesn't care who the king is? Here's why he's going to care. If Jesus is claiming to be the rightful king, and Herod is the rightful king, that's going to lead to civil war between them. That's going to be conflict. That's going to cause the attention of Rome. That's all of a sudden going to be a mess. Right? I don't care who is king. I just don't want the transition to be bloody, because if the transition is bloody, I look like I can't run my province. So that's the charges that they bring against Jesus. It's going to make him respond. It's going to make him get involved. He has no choice. He's got to deal with these. Now, the first one is, of course, a lie. Right? It's actually a 180-degree lie from what Jesus had publicly said. Right? When Jesus had been challenged just earlier that week in the temple, so should we pay taxes or not? What did Jesus say? Pay your taxes. Yes, render to Caesar what is Caesar's. You people out there, you should be paying your taxes. So to stand up and say, oh, this guy teaches you shouldn't pay your taxes, I mean, that's not even like a little twisting of the truth. That's just going, you know, 180 degrees in the opposite direction. This is blatant lying. The second, if Jesus claims to be king and challenges the Roman endorsed kingship of Herod, that's going to be bloody. And so that's the one that Pilate focuses on. I don't think Pilate was too concerned about the first one, because I think, again, the intel he got about what Jesus taught probably didn't cause him too many concerns about taxes. It's like, no, I've heard about what this guy teaches, and he doesn't say anything about not paying taxes. Okay? Now, I have heard he wants to be king. I have heard the people are claiming him to be the king. So Pilate focuses in on the king question. And we'll go back to John's account. So Pilate goes back inside the Praetorium. That's where he is, Herod's palace, called the Praetorium. And he has Jesus be brought to him. Now, we don't know if Jesus was there when the Sanhedrin brought him up. In other words, we don't know where Jesus is when the Sanhedrin is sort of challenging Pilate, hey, we want this guy executed. He may have been there, may not. The way it reads in the rest of Luke, it's kind of like he wasn't there. But here's why. So Pilate gets Jesus brought to him, and he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? It's interesting, if you kind of look at the way this is written, you can read it either like a question, like, hey, are you the king of the Jews? Or you can read it sort of like, so you're the king of the Jews? Right? Almost like, really? You think you're the king of the Jews? You? Because think about Jesus. All right, what is he doing? He's not looking good. He's been up all night. He's been beaten up. He probably doesn't look very kingly. Right? So you can almost read that like, really? This is it? You're the king of the Jews? Jesus answers him with this. When he's asked, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answers, are you saying this on your own initiative? Or did others tell you about me? Now see, that's why I'm kind of thinking he wasn't there when the Sanhedrin was making their initial conversation. Because he's kind of asking Pilate, you know, what's your concern here? Is your concern that I'm really a king of this world and I'm going to overthrow Herod and cause trouble and all of that? Is that what you're thinking? Or are you really kind of curious about what my kingship is about? Right? If Pilate is concerned, if Pilate's question is, so are you a threat to Herod? Are you going to be king of the Jews? Or are you going to rise up against Herod with your band of followers and try to overthrow him and take charge? Then Jesus can answer and say, no, I'm not a king like that. That's not what I'm about. Right? Jesus can honestly look Pilate in the eyes and say, no, that's not who I am. Okay? If Pilate's question has to do with spiritual matters, right, then it's a different answer. And Pilate tells him, he says, your own nation and your chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? So in other words, Pilate responds to Jesus' question by saying, I'm just going off of what these other people say. The Sanhedrin say, you want to be king of the Jews. Okay, what have you done? Why are they doing this? And so Jesus tries to explain to Pilate the kind of king he is, right? He recognizes that this is not about a political overthrow. Pilate knows that. So he wants Pilate to understand this is about a kingdom not of this world. And he says, if my kingdom is not of this world, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. In other words, if my kingdom, if I really was here to try to overthrow Herod, my band of followers would be fighting for me. But that's not what we're about. You know, sort of check the historical record. When one of them did fight for me, I told him to put his sword away. Right? I said, no, that's not what we're about. Okay? Pilate has nothing to fear from Jesus. And Jesus wants that made clear, not because he's afraid of being crucified. Jesus is not trying to get out of this. Jesus just wants it made clear what kind of king he is and why he is being crucified. Okay, he wants Pilate to know, you're not going to be able to get away with crucifying me as sort of a political rebel. I'm clearly not that. So Pilate just kind of asks again, so you're a king? Okay, your kingdom's not of this world, but you're a king, right? And Jesus simply says, you say correctly that I am a king. Luke summarizes all of this by simply Jesus is saying, it is as you say. Right? It is as you say. Then, if you go back to John's gospel, we'll not spend a lot of time with that, but then that's when Pilate kind of gets into the conversation because Jesus kind of explains the truth is, and Pilate kind of, what is truth? And they have this conversation. So Pilate, after this, steps out onto the balcony, because remember, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leaders, aren't coming inside because they don't want to be defiled. So he kind of goes out there, and he kind of announces to them, he said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. Why? Because he's not a threat to Rome. I find no guilt with this man. This guy has, he wants to be king of the Jews in some sort of spiritual sense, and that's your business. You deal with it. He hasn't violated any Roman law. He's not a threat to Rome. And frankly, this ought to end the matter. But we know it's not going to, because we know that they're not even playing by their own rules. So the Sanhedrin has not heard what they wanted to hear. Right? They are not getting what they want. Pilate has a problem. His problem is, again, what does he want to do? He wants to keep the peace. And the Jews are gathering in numbers. There's a lot of them. It's the Jewish leadership. They have a lot of pull with the people, and they aren't happy. And Pilate is looking for an escape here. Because he's essentially got two choices. If he gives in, if he just kind of says, I find no guilt in this man, and they keep fighting him, and he says, oh, okay, you can take him, then he's really lost whatever sort of power and prestige and influence he has over these people. It's like that teenager that kind of nags mom until they get what they want, you know? Right? It's like he can't go that way. On the other hand, if he continues to resist them and he continues to say, no, 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 who knows what's going to happen in the streets that night? Right? Are these people going to get thousands behind them? And is there going to be riots? And oh my gosh, Rome's going to come in. What are we going to do? And the Sanhedrin is not making it easy. Right? Luke says they kept on insisting. He stirs up the people. He's teaching all over Judea, beginning in Galilee, even as far as this place. Right? Again, he stirs up the people. Pilate, be concerned. You know? And Pilate, all of a sudden, his eyes must have lit up and he must have smiled. Galilee, you say? Oh, that's interesting. Pilate asks, so he's a Galilean? Yeah, he's a Galilean. And Pilate knows, he belongs to Herod's jurisdiction. This is my out card. Because now I can simply say, wait a second. We all know that Roman law allows you to be tried where your offenses are committed. And if he started in Galilee, if that's where he started stirring up the people, as you say, then he's out of my jurisdiction. He belongs to Herod. I'm so sorry. You're going to have to take him to Herod, and he'll have to decide this. I'm going back to bed. Right? That's what he does. He sends him to Herod. Herod's also in Jerusalem at that time. And he simply passes it off. He got his way out of it. He doesn't have to condemn Jesus and therefore look like he's giving in to the Sanhedrin. He doesn't have to say no to the Sanhedrin and run the risk of their rioting in the streets. He can simply sort of pass this off. So, Galilee, like I mentioned before, this is a hotbed of insurrection. I imagine when the Sanhedrin heard what Pilate said, and they said, take him to Herod. At first, they were probably a little discouraged, like, oh, man. But right away, I think they perked up. Because, again, Galilee is a source of insurrection. Herod's a king. Kings do not like insurrection. So they probably think, okay, we'll just play the zealot card against Herod. Okay? Herod Antipas is not somebody that was much of an improvement for Jesus to be brought before. Right? I mean, if he went from Pilate to Herod, he did not increase his likelihood of getting fairness, right? We've met Herod before. This is one of the sons of Herod the Great. When Herod the Great died about 4 BC or so, he divided his kingdom amongst three of his sons, and Herod Antipas sort of got the one that's Galilee and what's called Perea. and he rules that for several decades. Okay?
This is the Herod we have met before in a number of ways, and we'll get into that. But he, like Pilate, had no real love for the Jews. Okay, this was something that he did not do out of a sense of duty or loyalty or thinking of these are my people. One of the things he did was he built his capital city right over a Jewish cemetery. That is not something you do if you want the locals to love you. You sort of desecrate their holy ground. Right? That's where he built his capital city. He had grown up in Rome, and he did improve a lot of things. He tried, like any good king, to sort of butter up the people by improving things. He built, like I said, that one big city, kind of built it over a Jewish cemetery. That wasn't great. The next one he builds is Sepphoris, and he builds this one. And it's kind of interesting. I was doing a little bit of thinking and research about this. Sepphoris is about just a few miles from Nazareth. So it would be kind of interesting to wonder if Joseph, as a carpenter, maybe did some contract work helping to build that city as he was performing his duties. Maybe his adolescent son came along and kind of apprenticed under him. I don't know. Just something that I think about. Herod, what we do know is he had married the daughter of a neighboring ruler for sort of an alliance system, like I'm going to marry the daughter of the king next door, and that'll keep our countries getting along. But one time he's visiting his brother, and he falls for his wife, his brother's wife, Herodias. Right? They begin to have an affair. She's not only obviously the wife of another, but being the wife, she's actually his niece, the way all the marriages worked out. They both agree to leave their spouses and take up in marriage together. And it's for this that John the Baptist spoke out against him. Right? That's sort of the background. You remember we talked about John the Baptist. And John the Baptist Herod imprisons John the Baptist, and then later on has him executed, right, when his own stepdaughter wants that. Herod and Jesus had not met, but their experiences had crossed paths a couple times. Herod had heard of Jesus. We studied this a while back, but if you recall, when Jesus sent out the 12, there's a lot of good things happening in terms of the kingdom of God, and Herod hears about this. Herod heard about all that was happening, and he was greatly perplexed because it was said by some that John had risen from the dead, right? So word comes to Herod that, wow, there are some things moving out in the kingdom here, your kingdom, and people are repenting, and they're saying things, and Herod's like, well, I thought we killed John the Baptist. This sounds like everything he did. Others say Elijah had appeared, and others that one of the prophets. And Herod himself, he said, I myself had John beheaded. Who is this man about whom I hear such things? And he wanted to meet him. Herod says, I want to meet this guy that is doing all of this stuff that I'm hearing about. Because I know it's not John the Baptist, because I had him killed. I don't believe in Elijah or one of the prophets rising from the dead. So who is this person? They did not meet. Right? Jesus knew better. Right? Jesus knew better. Later, rumor spreads that Herod wants his life. People tell Jesus when he's preaching in a certain area. The Pharisees approached, saying, hey, you better go away, leave here. Herod wants to kill you. Right? So you can kind of see what's happened. Who's this guy? What's going on? I want to meet him. Well, he doesn't want to meet you. Okay, well, let's ratchet up the pressure a little bit. Let's just kill the guy. Right? If he doesn't want to meet and talk, let's just take care of it. Okay? It doesn't say specifically why Herod wanted him killed, but I think that's a good reason. I think there's a lot of ways this connects. A potential rival. Right? Jesus never presented himself as a king, but the people did. Right? We remember in John's gospel, they wanted to make him king, and Jesus left. Right? Maybe Herod is concerned that because he murdered John the Baptist, Jesus is going to somehow try to avenge his death. Maybe it's just that typical local Roman ruler thing of, if this guy's stirring up trouble, it's going to eventually cause the attention of Rome, and I just need that not to happen, right? Because if there's one thing Rome likes, it's peace and quiet. So whether this guy is an actual threat or just a potential threat, we just need to keep him down. Finally, now the two meet, okay? And Luke writes that Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus. Why was he glad? Well, it wasn't any interest, any real interest, because Luke continues, he had wanted to see him for a long time, yeah, we know that, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. Jesus is there. Herod finally gets to see him, and Herod wants a miracle. He wants entertainment. So this is the guy. Okay, let's see what he's got. I've heard about raising the dead, feeding thousands, miracles. Great. In a controlled environment, my palace, my soldiers, let's put this guy on display. Show me what you can do. That's what Herod wants. That's why he's excited. Herod questioned him at some length. Jesus gives him no satisfaction. Jesus has nothing to say to Herod. Despite the questioning, you can imagine Herod trying to play every heavy sort of bad cop trick he can, right? Jesus answered him nothing, Luke writes. He offers no defense. I think Herod had been given his chances. I think one of the things I read here is this sense that, you know, Herod, you've had your opportunities to learn truly about Jesus. You had John the Baptist. You don't get sort of another presentation of the gospel here. You know, Jesus explained who he was to Pilate. He gave Pilate sort of the benefit of the doubt and said, no, my kingdom's not of this world. Here's who I am. Here's what I'm about. In sort of a very brief sense. It's not like he made a whole gospel message. But he let Pilate in on it. Herod gets nothing. Herod gets nothing from Jesus. Again, this too, a fulfillment of prophecy. You know your Isaiah. He was oppressed. He was afflicted. Yet he did not open his mouth like a lamb led to the slaughter. Like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. Well, what does Herod think of Jesus? Probably not much. Again, if Herod is the king to whom this Jesus is the rival, right? If this is my threat, this is the guy who wants my job, Jesus must not have cut a very imposing figure. Right? Again, he's been up all night, he's been beaten up. He has no followers. I mean, maybe he did have a few dozen, but, you know, a cohort of Roman soldiers, and they disappeared into the night, right? They scattered like none other. So this is not much of a threat to me. And with all the chief priests and the scribes standing there accusing him, Herod's got to believe even this rabbi's own people don't want him to be king. I mean, this guy is no threat. And so Herod, just in frustration, he's not getting what he wants. He's not getting entertainment. Herod, with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe, sent him back to Pilate. Herod is not even be bothered with this. Herod just washes his hands of it and says, Pilate, you sent him to me because he's in my jurisdiction. I don't see a threat here. Not worth my time. He is not worth the trouble. And then there's this little footnote, right? It's not actually a footnote, but it reads that way. Luke says, Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other. Like, you can imagine when you've got sort of a local Jewish king who's sort of subcontracted out by Rome to kind of manage the Jews, and then you've got the local Roman official who's kind of there to do all the government side of things. There's going to be a controversy and conflict over you know, sort of who's in charge where, right? Herod's in theory in charge of all the Jews. Pilate's in charge of sort of the political boundaries. Naturally, there's going to be a conflict over who has jurisdiction in this area and that area. And that had happened on more than one occasion, right? On more than one occasion. One we've already talked about, when Pilate killed all those Galileans who were down there offering the sacrifice, those were Herod's subjects, right? Another time was when Pilate had sort of brought in banners and things sort of demonstrating loyalty to the gods on his side into Herod's palace. Herod kind of appealed to Rome and made him get him out of there. But now these two kind of make up. These two kind of make up, and they sort of put their past aside over Jesus in a way that both agree that this guy is not worth the trouble and we had better stick together on that. Now, when we look at a passage like this, I'm always kind of, what do we take away? And I think there's lots of things to look at. You know, we could look at, you know, Jesus' commitment to finish the road he began, right? He set his face towards Jerusalem. And Jesus made up his mind, he is going to the cross. And as the pressure mounts and as the physical pain of this begins to increase, he continues to be faithful to his cause. I think we can applaud his perseverance in this and his humility. Again, one of the things that every time we read a story of the crucifixion, I think you have to go back to is that as horrible as that would be for anybody, to think of a God, to think of God himself suffering that is just a gap my mind can't bridge. You know, we've all been in various humiliating places, right? And it's humiliating and whatever that was, you know, we're sinful people. Most of that we bring on ourselves. This is God himself, God incarnate. And then I think we can look at his love for us. Nothing else motivated him. He had no other reason to do this than of his love for us. He had nothing to gain from this. I mean, he's God. He's at the right hand of the Father. I mean, you know, he's not going to improve his status somewhere. Right? He has no motivation to do this but love. So I think you can look at all of those. But what I want to take away, what kind of, as I was thinking, is to see how Satan works in this. And how the way Satan works in this is the way he perhaps works in your life. Speaking with the Pharisees earlier, Jesus had said this. He said, "You are of your father the devil. You do, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning, and he does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature. For he is a liar and the father of lies." Lying is Satan's oldest strategy. Spreading lies about the people of God is what he has always done. Right? He has always done this. And I drew just three examples out of the Old Testament. David wrote this. "Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask me of things that I do not know. People make accusations about me that I have no knowledge of." I have no knowledge of this. And yet these people keep bringing this up. Ahab accused Elijah. "Is this you, you troubler of Israel?" Elijah only wanted what was best for Israel. He is a prophet sent to Israel to turn them back to God. But to Ahab, he's a troubler of Israel. And King Zedekiah's advisors spoke of Jeremiah this way. "Let this man be put to death, inasmuch as he is discouraging the men of war who are left in this city and all the people by speaking such words to them. For this man is not seeking the well-being of his people, but rather their harm." Really? Jeremiah wasn't seeking the well-being of his people? That was his whole mission in life. Satan is the father of lies. And if you are a child of God, I am sure you will, if you have not already, encounter a time when lies are used against you. When people will take your good actions and attribute to them some sort of malicious motive. When people will always paint it in the worst light. When they will always find something that's just slightly off and make it so much bigger than it is. If you take a stand for Christ, this is what you must bear. And so I think our takeaway is to pray for grace to respond to it the way Jesus did. To allow God to work in that situation, to stay humble, and to stay true to what we are called to do as sons and daughters of the Most High God. So let's go in that. And Lord, we will. We will just ask for your grace. Ask that you fill us with your Spirit, because we do not want to do this in our flesh. Lord, when we are spoken wrongly of, when we are accused of things we do not do, when things are said about us that are not true, Lord, please give us the grace to hold our tongue where it needs to be held and to speak salt and light when we do, that we might continue to be witnesses for your kingdom.
Let us not be concerned about ourselves or our ego or our reputation, but more than our character matter, that we are sons and daughters of the Most High God. Amen.